date.
Okay.
May 31st.
May 31st.
2000.
2000.
Tape number 7.
Tape number 7. Well, as I was saying, life goes on. I mean, very well pursued things in a compulsive way. You really have to keep busy. Maybe this was what everyone had to do. I remember visiting my brothers, who had set up a trailer just outside of London, and the idea was that we could escape the bombings, and we learned to escape the bombings. When the weather was right, we'd get on and go out there and live in this trailer. This is in Rickmansworth. And then one day there was a huge attack on London. We thought, my God, we're lucky to get the hell out of there. And then all of a sudden, a German plane appeared. And I never realized that an airplane can surrender. I never knew that. I mean, how does an airplane surrender? Did they hold a white flag out of the window? No. No, there'd be a... Typically, there'd be a situation where a plane had been attacked, the captain killed, and there was a gunner trying to control the aircraft, and he would want to surrender. And the British would talk to him in German and order him to drop his undercarriage. And an undercarriage is the sign of surrender of an aircraft in battle or during the bombing attack. So I learned this in this place of refuge out in Rickmansworth. So if you saw this low-flying German plane, the smoke was issuing out of it. And also, we in Rickmansworth, there was this lake.
I don't think you saw the tape, what Rickman is, you're on.
Rickmansworth, yeah.
Rickmansworth,
yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But that you and your brothers had a... I don't think that... I'm not sure that's on the tape, but you and your brothers...
would spend the week...
Trailer out there.
Yeah. A trailer and a tent, stuff like that. And, well, the plane came in low, and then dropped its bombs in our lake, you see. And anyway, there was another attack. Then we had to go back to London Monday, you know, pursuing our different jobs. And then we'd be back the following weekend. And the Germans love to attack on the weekend if the weather conditions were right, because then this screws up the rest of the people. There's sort of a psychological edge to these attacks. And sure enough, another plane comes in. You see, its undercarriage is down. And they were led, in this instance, they were led to a lake by this hurricane fighter. And they dropped the goddamn bombs, you know, in the lake, you see. That was a surrendered aircraft.
So why would they drop the bombs? Would explode then? Or?
Yes. Yeah.
The lake was a safe place to do that?
Right, yeah. And then they'd go in, there was an airstrip for these people to land. So, that was a strange... That was strange. I remember at school, the military visited the schools and spoke to the senior boys. I'm now a senior boy. And they explained this business with these toys that Germans are dropping. They call them butterfly bombs, and that we should watch the younger children. But they had a serious complaint. They had rubber tanks and artillery, which were phony. It was done to fool the Germans. And they inflate these very realistic-looking tanks. And as boys, we'd go out there and have a wonderful time jumping up and down on these things. And anyway, the military people explained that we shouldn't do that, because if a reconnaissance plane took a photo of us jumping up and down on the phony tank, it would destroy the whole effort. And furthermore, they'd shoot any of us who pulled this because there were too many lives involved. But we were welcome to come and stand guard on these things and so on and so forth. So that ended a lot of fun when we play on these were like, to us, these were like giant toys. But then I think we realized that we couldn't mess about anymore with these things.
Was this when you were staying with your brothers, or was this when you lived in
Banbury? This is when I was in Banbury, where we were evacuated.
Okay, and that was for 1 year, as I recall.
Yeah, just over a year. Yeah.
And you were evacuated there in about 1937?
38.
Yeah. And why did you return to London then to live? I mean, the bombing hadn't stopped. Why would you not stay out?
Why would a 15 and a half or 16-year-old want to remain, you know?
Yeah, but you were younger than that, I think. I
was
10 or 11 when you were evacuated, right?
Right.
Did you have the choice to go back to London? Was that?
No, not really, no.
But for some reason, you went back.
I wanted to go back, yeah.
But it was for some, how was that decided? Do you remember how that came about?
I convinced my father, number one, that I should be bar mitzvahed. But this is really a trick to get back to London. And he came to Banbury and tried to dissuade me from this. He said, I discussed this with the rabbi, and you can do this at some later. I said, no, I've got to do it now, Dad. And he said, well, then you have to learn something by rote, by heart, you know, the lesson. So I did, and I was allowed to come in to London. And the synagogue was really an old, old building with a glass roof. Next to it was a Russian steam bath, I remember, with olive trees under glass. And in the morning, this huge Turkish masseur would cut the branches that he would flagellate people with, you see. And anyway, here I am in the adjoining building, which is this old synagogue, and you need like a minion or like a quorum of, you have to have so many people, otherwise God doesn't hear you, you see. So these old people were there, you know, and old people, and I felt kind of bad about this, you know, but I got on with it. And then bombs started dropping and glass came down and dust but these old geezers just stood up there, you know. I was tempted to hit the floor, you know. So anyway after that I decided to remain in London. There was a kind of a subterranean life too. You could people lived in tubes. There was entertainment in tubes and food, you know. And then I liked the crowd at Unity Theatre and the crowd at the BBC. And then I joined Regent's Polytechnic with kind of a boxing scholarship to study engineering. And that was on Regent Street across from the BBC. And the BBC people had a wonderful restaurant, see, and it was for their own staffers, but the guys, the boxers from Regent's Party would go over there and eat, and people would turn a blind eye to this, you know. So there were all these things going on.
Well, now, that was going on. You went to Regent Polytechnic for scholarship there. You also went to
East Ham Technical College, which was an engineering college near the district where I was lived.
Mm-hmm. What about when you went to the settlement house? How was that?
It was at the same time. I'd go there for art lessons, you know.
Yep. Just art
lessons. And then I would drop, some other things that I was doing, you know. Then adjacent to the settlement house was the Oxford and St. George's Club, which, now I'm living in Bow, which is kind of an upscale neighborhood.
With your parents?
Yes, yeah. Except I see very little of them. They were in bomb shelters, you know. And so I had the run of the house. This is in Mile End, where Wat Tyler was run through by the knights of King Richard. At Mile End in the East End of London. Mile End.
How do you spell it?
Mile, like 1 mile, 2 miles,
oh,
3 miles.
Oh, Mile End.
Yeah, Mile End, yeah. Mile End Road.
Okay.
This was the main road, I believe it's called Roman Road. And, but still, if you were interested in boxing, you'd have to travel into the East End, like a toreador would go into the hills to look at the new crop of bulls, you see. And I felt that I was a boxer, you know, scientific in my approach, didn't accept punishment, could hand that out, and, you know, cleverness. So, I'm doing these things, but I became involved with the people at Unity Theatre. Of course, that was the gaggle of actors, scene designers, costume people in doing costumes and stuff like that. All this is going on at the same time. There was this painter, Earl Kirkham, and this painter, Earl Kirkham, in New York now, at the old Pagano's Gallery. And Earl would turn up in your home and would for dinner, and he would eat. And he would eat at the Hopkins house. And then the Hopkins discovered a notebook he left. And in the notebook were all the homes that he went to. Every day of the week, there was a place where he'd catch a dinner, you see. And my life was kind of like that. I had something going on. My son now reminds me of that. You know, he has a kind of a singular interest in enormous energy, you know, and a photographic memory, which I don't think I ever had. You know. I think a lot of my mates died in the war. Those who were a year ahead of me died fighting. Yeah. I think my experience with Kokoschka was I think the drawings, the way a man goes about something, were electrifying to me. I still see them. And I've seen so much art work out by great painters. You know, I see that man's work. In a way, I was kind of resentful of him for another reason. It's England, and he had almost an immediate entree into society, which I didn't have. See. And he was accompanied by a count who also fled Austria, and the count would see that he received commissions and stuff like that. So here's this newcomer driven to England, and yet he's on his feet, you know. That kind of amazed me that, you know, patronage that painters could become part of. It just goes like a web over that, over the, you know, Western civilization. And you know, I thought then that, you know, this is so easy to do, you know, but and it is easy to do, except when you have to kind of articulate and defend what you have done. You see, yes, it is. There are people who, in all walks of life, who resent anything that's, who resent a new way of looking at something. See, they don't like it. In this state, for instance, you have people will run out on the rail from New York who were illustrators. You know, it was their job before the advent of the camera and before the advent of photojournalism. There were people who would draw battle scenes. And, you know, if they can turn out something that looked like a Kodak Brownie camera, they were in like Flynn and they were great illustrators. And you have illustrators who have come here, like Marquetance and this other guy, you know, Lawrence. But they were illustrators and they can no longer find work, you see. And they come up here and they're absolutely welcomed, you know, because the paintings don't resonate any problem, you know, or thought, you know, nothing, you see. It's a kind of painting that's favored in autocracies or in dictatorships, you know.
Social realism. Yeah. Not exactly, but
yeah.
Leaning that way.
Leaning that way, yeah. You do anything else, and there's opposition, you know. You're the point is, the gallery was relatively a new gallery. It started on 38th Street, and we were back, of course, in New York, and it was run originally by George Poindexter, who was would always have his office for his company either above the gallery or below it. If there was another floor, he'd rent this to someone, and he would rent this to some movie star. See, and there was one I remember. She was very nice, but I can't think of her name. I probably will. Anyway, the gallery was informal. To show early abstract expressionistic work, you would have to have an informal tone, to say the least. You were inviting your visitors would be the madmen of the mad people of your nation, you know. Certainly, people who were reasonable would come in and excoriate the work in articles and so on and so forth. Also, there were other things, because it wasn't an experience gallery, there were things they permitted. For instance, in an art gallery, the painter isn't allowed in there if he is exhibiting work, or for that matter, if he is not. They don't like that. So the painters keep away. But this wasn't true at the point of the gallery. George says, these sons of bitches aren't buying anything, so if you guys want to come in and drink coffee, you know, be my guest, you know, welcome. Well, anyway, Robert De Niro had a show, and it was of black and white drawings, and he really worked with very thick incrustations of paint. Yeah, with the, you know, with the gorgeous sculptural lyric of line. That this man was a great painter, but as Marcia Shapiro said of him, he has a wheel missing, and so it was difficult. Having him in the gallery when his work was aloft was really a mistake of the first magnitude. But anyway, the painters were permitted to gather and socialize, you see. Yes, we'd have coffee, and then we'd go a couple of blocks south to the Museum of Modern Art, or a couple of blocks north to see what shows were going on by the painters like Picasso and Braque, you know. One night I was at the Cedar, and at the old Cedar Tavern, now there's a new splendiferous Cedar Tavern, and on the corner you could look out the bar, and on the corner there was a little lamppost, and for some reason if people had been to an opening and they had something to drink, they were feeling gay, they'd hold onto that lamppost and swing around it. And Gallagher and Sheen were out there. That would be William de Kooning and Franz Klein. And they were having a whirl of a time, and they were both clasping this little lamppost, which had been worn smooth where artists had done this sort of thing. And I remember de Kooning spun away from the lamppost and said, you know, those Braques are green and yellow. He said they look like dollar bills, you know what I mean? They look like enlarged $20 and $50 bills. They look like money! Back to the lamppost, and he'd swing around it, this 60-year-old man acting like a child. Wonderful. Anyway, I said, Bob is showing work tomorrow. And Robert De Niro, myself, and Gandy Brody were never abandoned the figure, see. And there were other painters who accept influence, never transcended, and gave us all sorts of shit. They were a problem, you see, that we had not abandoned the figure. Or that Bob would have a sort of a biblical touch to his work. Lot in Sodom, this figure in salt staring, you know, you see, kind of a simple painting. But we always had the figure, and of course we would do abstract works for group shows, you know, because this is what everyone is doing, you see. I mean, there was a lot of criticism over this, but anyway, once again, Bob was doing sketches in black and white. I saw them in the work process. I thought, God, this is just great, you know, with an enriched white, you know, kind of drawings where the white of the pad is incorporated as a color, you know, difficult. I mean, it's not as easy as it looks. Yeah. And the person he had chosen for this one-man show was the actress Greta Garbo. And no one had come to see the show. I think Franz Klein came up there.
What do you mean by, when you said the person he had chosen was Greta Garbo, you mean as a figure?
As a figure, yeah. Her head and stuff like this. Maybe he may have derived this from the memory of movies. He would see her movies compulsively. There was always a movie of Greta Garbo in New York, the downtown Apollo, and on 42nd Street, on the west side of it. And they'd pop up all over the place. There'd be festivals, and during a festival he would drink in the image and then paint it. Anyway, here was this splendid room of these wonderful works of Greta Garbo by Robert De Niro. And nothing was happening, you know. There was barely an opening for this affair because the main gallery, you know, had the main opening. And
I don't understand that.
The main gallery had oil paintings, you see.
By other people?
No, by one person who was...
The solo show.
Yeah. I think the painter's name was... never mind. I think it was Sam Francis. So anyway, we had the antechamber of De Niro's work. For that matter, whoever was in the main gallery, there wasn't much business there either, you see. So once again, the painters would gather and sit down and drink coffee or bring in hamburgers. Since we're up on 57th Street now, finding hamburgers or hot dogs is a neat trick. You'd have to go over to Central Park, which would commence where the plaza is. So you have to walk and shuttle about four city blocks. Anyway, we'd be eating hot dogs and stuff like that. And the little gallery of Poindexter's at that time had a bow window. And you could stand in it and look up 57th Street one way and then look down the other way. And the other galleries, the Sagittarius was above us, had a bow window too. There was a circular staircase and also a little three-man elevator to go up and down. And, I thought, poor old Bob is having a rough day, you know. This isn't a good idea. Not for anyone to come to the gallery, you know. There was a good review, however, for this in the Art News. That was encouraging. This is before the Village Voice, so there's no help there. And I'm looking out the bow window, and I couldn't believe it. There was Greta Garbo walking from Fifth Avenue down. We were just a block over from Tiffany's, and I looked and I thought, my God, that's Greta Garbo. She's heard about the show. She's coming to see Bob's work. And I ran back and I said, Bob, you won't believe this, but Greta Garbo is coming. And I dragged into the bow window. We looked down, I said, there she is. You know. And she's walking along the sidewalk in those huge glasses. And then she walked into the building. She disappeared. I said, she's in the building. And we could hear the elevator going up, you know. And but the elevator kept going, you know. There's just a little three-story building.
You were
but
on the second floor?
Yeah.
The Sagittarius?
Yeah.
Sagittarius
was above us on the third floor.
The third. Okay.
Yeah.
So George had ground floor.
And the second floor.
And the second floor.
Yeah. And we ran down into the street. We thought maybe she'd entered, but no. That was my idea, but I knew that she hadn't done this. And and I said, well, I don't know where the hell she went. Maybe she'll turn up in a little while. And then nothing happened. And I said, damn it, I think she's upstairs. I can't believe this. Maybe she made a mistake and went to the wrong gallery. So Bob was really in bad shape over this. And I said, don't worry, I'll bring her here. She made a mistake. So I go upstairs, and there was this show of nothing paintings by some fashionable painter I never heard of. His name was Manolo. And he was talking to Greta Garbo and escorted her out of the gallery. And comes back to the gallery, and I jumped into the elevator with this lady, you know. So here I am in close proximity to her. And I told her about Robert's show, and meanwhile, we'd already passed the second floor. And then I started shouting at her with just a few swear words I learned when I served in the Danish Merchant Marine. You know, I came here on a Danish ship, went to the Middle East in a Danish ship. And I said, I don't know how you can do this. And look at the paintings of some pimp like that. You know, it's disgusting. And anyway, she hurried off. And I went back to the gallery. And we just acquired a manager. That was Bud Hopkins. And I said, man, I can't believe this. I said, here are these paintings. And that son of a bitch was up there looking at this fucking guy's work. I mean, who is this? I mean, it's nothing work. So we all went up there. And we thought, well, be at the line in his den. And here was this fellow, Manolo. And he was just this porcine creature. Porcine, you know. Pig-like, porcine, and he had stationed himself in his bow window up above us, you know, where there were no pictures, where that's where he would be alone, and you'd have no reason to stand beside him. And we're looking at this fellow from head to foot. He was just immaculate. We have the usual patina that goes with wondering where your next meal is coming from. And I've had a temptation to, you know, clean my shoes on the other side of my pants. And, I mean, I really felt inferior to this guy, you know. And, I mean, I once saw Clark Gable in a restaurant, and I felt inferior to Clark Gable. But this is a normal thing, you know, of course. You know, this handsome man, but here's this handsome man with coiffed hair and every hair, you know, exact, and his clothing, and here are these, and he had the Aga Khan. It seems that the son of the Aga Khan was making a resort out of this part of Sardinia, and these were cottages of peasants or what have you in Sardinia, you see. So this was the fashion, this was the place to be, you know, before it became popular, you know, in this spread of things by the Aga Khan's son or successor. And damn, I always thought about that. That here was someone totally oblivious to what we were doing, and left the building, you know. I would have pursued her, but then she's Greta Garbo, and there are police, and they would have hustled me away or what have you. But that was a terrible day for De Niro, you know. He never ceased to love that lady and her acting and what have you. I mean, just...
Now,
Jacqueline Bouvier was, when she was Jacqueline Bouvier, came to the Hoffman School. And then when she became the First Lady, would leave the Kennedy compound at Hyannis and go up the road and attend the Christmas. So, and sometimes, and she would bring her own work for private Christmas by Hans Hoffman. So she understood, you see, and but fashion too kind of blinds people too, you know. But what a disaster that was for Bobby that day, just terrible. And I explained anything. I mean, what the hell can we do? You know, how do you explain this? It's like the story I told you about Kokoschka and Kafka. Did I remember? See, it's like that where, how does one explain that disparity? And a fellow who has a literary vision would not tolerate that in in a painting, you see. Mystery.
Yeah. Do you feel as impassioned today about painting as you did?
Yeah, when I paint, I feel as impassioned. Except I'm much older, and one time I did choreographic paintings, never abandoning the figure. And they were choreographic, you know, swiftly done. I wonder where the hell they all went. There was one painting, the yellow duck. I don't know where the hell, that was the best painting I ever did. I don't know where the hell that is.
Do you feel like you have done your masterpiece?
I think the way, yeah, to me a masterpiece is dying, hanging clown.
Where is it?
It's at the museum up here. It's just a small painting. I'll be doing a print edition of that. And it's a war painting. What's it about? It, the death camps that were established by the Germans, Sobibor, if a prisoner tried to escape, they'd go into these minefields. Sometimes they get injured in the minefield, a leg would be blown away, but they take them back to the camp and dress them as clowns and hang them at a morning assembly, you see. And here's this little luminous painting, you know. And to me, that's the best thing I ever did.
How long ago did you do that?
About 5 years ago. Just happened naturally. And, I think I put the whole thing to rest with that, because there were other things that where I tried to catch the soul of a departing soul, you know. Mm-hmm. How do you do that? Well, I tried, and I love it. Oddly enough, when people are around, I do good work. It seems difficult for me to be alone. It's difficult.
Like in your studio?
Yeah. But I feel the mind appears to be young in this respect, you know. And, yeah. And it's as if I never thought that, like, the experience of color is such that it all comes about and comes to bear, you know. And I don't know how that happens. Whenever I start something, I think, I don't know what I'm doing. It's as if I start all over again, but that can't be true, you know. But it is as if I am starting again. Then I'm just kind of amazed at the colors, the form, you know.
Do you ever do commissions?
No, I've not really pursued that, but I'd be happy to do that. I think the only I did a commission for to do a watercolor, a monoprint of Pike's for the owner who was leading it, Chuck Trussell's. And I went out there, did some sketches, and he came by here, and it's in Sitka now. He's had it splendiferously framed, and that was a commission I did. That must be another commission I did once. But yeah, when I came here, a fellow approached me, and this goes back almost 40 years. He said, "Did you know that Jackson Pollock?" Meanwhile, Jackson Pollock was rolling around the media, you see. Everyone had heard of him. And he said, "You see this?" And it was Time magazine. And there was a full page of a Jackson Pollock. He said, "Can you do that?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "It's quite easy." He said, "No, I can't do it." And Dr. Beckley wants a copy of this. So I did that, and I got about $50 for it. You know? And the bastard who had me do this claimed that he painted the damn thing. But I was very grateful for the $50. But that was the only major commission. I remember having it on the floor in this bachelor's nest and begging people not to walk over it. And but man, that was a beautiful replication of work. You know, and I thought, my God, this is something. Only I could do this. You know, having
Do you feel like you are painting much now, or are you feeling inspired much?
Yeah. I just want to do it every day.
So you're painting out in the studio?
No, not every day, but I'm going to get around to it. I think I need the sketch group. I think at the university they want me to, wants me to work, do some monoprinting there, you know.
So,
yeah, Todd. And I think I'll take him up on that offer. Strange, once upon a time I would work alone, but now it's difficult, you know. And I was watching this movie of Ronald Reagan, who reached the age of 73 and is already going kind of, I thought, my God, can this be happening to me, you know? Well, I hope not.
I don't think so. He's definitely got an illness.
What
you've got is probably something to do with a lack of a habit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, having gotten away from it. And it's hard to work. Like you said, it's like you start over every time.
Yeah.
And very hard to break the habit of not doing things. That's my hunch, anyway.
Yeah. Well, I'm lucky that I feel that way. That, my God, what do I do now? You know, it's as if I'm confronted the problem for the first time. And if, however, you know, I arrive with some sort of aplomb and commence work, I think, nothing good will happen. Mm-hmm. And something happens that's facile. Mm-hmm. You see?
That's what you're afraid of, or that does happen?
I know how to counter that. If the work becomes facile, I paint with my right hand. My brain obviously is not controlling the brush. I become a creature of that, okay? But if I switch the brush to the left hand, that's awkward, all right, but the brain takes control, and things happen, accidental things happen. But what was facile goes out the window, you know. That's what you do if you're a painter and become facile. Just change hands, see what happens. You'll have a problem with control, but that's a blessing because accidents happen. That's great, you know.
Yeah.
So when I feel strange, I see a light at the end of the tunnel. That's, you know, but it's strange, really. I figure, you know, you're now 73 years of age, and you don't know what, you know, you don't know how to begin here, you know, and looking around and other people, so their work will save you, you know. And then I get into it, and damn this thing, you know. Where do these colors come from? And it can't be entirely accidental, because there's a consistency, you know. Yeah. Just change your hand, and the brain has to take over.